Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Plane Talk Podcast. It's just Rob right now. Matt's out. And we're having some busy live problems right now. We can't seem to get together. We got together Wednesday night. We did an interview with a pilot that Matt grew up with. It's basically been his neighbor since he was a little kid. And we wanted to take an opportunity to talk with him and see if he had any pearls of wisdom for us. Being an experienced aviator and having gone through all of the flight training and everything that everybody else has done. And that's one of those things I want to emphasize is that all these professional pilots that are out there, they all started in the same place as any student pilot. They were all the same at one point, and it comes from a passion about wanting to fly and enjoying the experience and really loving getting out there and doing the job. And so we're going to have some highlights a little bit later. But anyway, right now we're getting ready and geared up, and Oshkosh is just around the corner. And it has been, I don't want to say necessarily a nightmare, but it's been a bit of a struggle trying to get out to Oshkosh this year. We put together a program and a package to try and take, what was it, one, two, three, I think we were taking three or four students out. We were going to fly the Duchess and the Arrow, and the Duchess was getting a new engine put on it, and when we were doing the run-up and doing the test flying, we just couldn't get the carburetor to work right, and it's very interesting. It's actually running too lean of a mixture, even at full rich. It's just not getting quite enough gas, and it's just enough of a problem that we don't want to put paying customers in it. We don't want to put students in it. We don't want to do any of that. So it was supposed to be a training trip that you would come out and fly the Duchess and get some multi-engine experience and have a good time with it. But unfortunately, hey, if we don't trust the carburetor to do its job, we're not going to put somebody in that airplane. So we made the decision, no, we're not going to do that. And unfortunately, the people that were in the Arrow originally then backed out because their friends weren't going in the Duchess. And it just kind of turned into a bit of a fiasco. And the company said, hey, Rob, if you can find somebody to go, then, you know, you're going. But in the meantime, hey, we'll plan on as if it's not going to happen. So I'm like, oh, geez, okay, well, I'll reach out to everybody I can. And all the likely candidates reached out to them, and they said, oh, that sounds awesome. It sounds like a great deal. And just right now I can't get away from work, or I don't have the money, or, you know, there's all kinds of things in life happening, and people can't make the commitment. And so finally, it was the last night. It was Sunday night. About a week ago now, that had the conversation with the boss, and he said, hey, no, if we can't make this happen before tonight, and we're probably not going to go. And we had to have that conversation Sunday night. Nope, don't have anybody. You? Nope, don't have anybody. All right, well, it's not going to happen. I'm like, oh, man, just devastation and disappointment at not being able to go out there to Oshkosh. And it's one of those experiences that if you're a pilot, you gotta get out there. And so here I am, rather disheartened, driving into work on Monday morning, and I'm racking my brain, sitting in typical Boston traffic, not going anywhere. And I'm thinking, what can I do? How can I make this happen? And I said to myself, well, you know, maybe there's a deal here. Maybe there's something I can work out. What if I pay for a seat? What if I occupy one of the seats? And that way, a customer doesn't have to front the full price. And if we could find one person, maybe I can make that happen. And maybe I can get the company to cover a little bit of it too, and I'll mention the company, and I'll put together an advertising deal, and I call my boss, and he goes, you know what, I love your hustle, I can't commit to it right now, but let me chew on it, let me think about it, let me come up with something, and we'll see what we can do. I'd love for you to go. I love that you're still motivated. Let's see what we can do. So we hung up the phone, and I'm all right, sliver of hope, 20% chance, maybe 30. So I go out to the dispatch area, and I'm sitting with the manager, young kid named Rylan Richards. He's working on his instrument training, and I didn't know that at the time. He works 2 days a week for the school that I'm at, but then the rest of his time, he's down at the other school in the Providence location, and he's working on his instrument down there, and he just off the cuff says, "Yeah, I'm gonna fire back up instrument flying on Wednesday." And I looked at him and said, "What are your goals with aviation?" He goes, "Oh, I want to be a commercial pilot, and I want to be a CFI. I want to teach for you guys." And I said, "Dude, awesome. Do you need a cross country?" He goes, "Yeah." "Do you need 10 hours of complex time for your commercial?" He goes, "Yeah." "Do you want to go to Oshkosh?" He goes, "Yeah." They're like, "I have a deal for you." So I pick up this guy. He says, "Okay, well, hold on. I gotta get time off because I have to work at times, and I gotta make sure my shifts are covered and my girlfriend doesn't miss me." I'm like, "Dude, cover those bases. I gotta go fly. Let's see if we can make this happen." He calls the boss. The boss says, "You know what? That's awesome. Yeah, let's do it." The girlfriend's okay with it. We got a guy to cover his shift, so you know, we're all good. So now we're getting ready to leave Monday morning at 0:30, and we're gonna head out to Oshkosh. And we're finally going to get to go. Going to get to have a great time. We're going to hope to interview a bunch of people out there. Got a bunch of stuff lined up to talk to air show performers and some other guests that will be there. And hopefully we'll have some awesome videos and content for Instagram. And yeah, it's going to be one heck of a good time. Oshkosh 2018 Plane Talk Podcast. And my phone. This is perfect timing. My phone's ringing. Here comes Matt. Welcome back, Matt.
What's up? How are you?
I'm good. We finally, so I started off, you weren't here for this part of the recording, but I started recording and I said, "Hey, it's just Rob right now because you're busy and I'm busy and life is nuts right now."
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy since Wednesday night, but.
Yep. So I talked a little bit about Dave and interviewing Dave, and we'll have some content for that here in a little while, which I think that's going to be good.
Awesome. Yeah, we also have our ATC memes interview that got rescheduled for another week or two. So we'll get that going. And we actually have an FR-24, Flight Radar 24 interview coming up as well. So so bear with us till episode 12 on some of this stuff, but we're going to have some pretty good content. We're pretty excited about it.
Oh, and if Matt sounds a little different today, that's because he's in his apartment and I'm in my house. This is the first time we're trying to do any kind of remote recording or anything like that.
Yes.
So we'll see.
It's going to be interesting.
We'll see how this goes. Oh, boy. So let's see. This episode, we want to say good luck to Tammy. Tammy's out in Australia. She sent us an email last week saying, "I'm going for my pre-solo stage check. Is there any advice?" I believe I just told her, have fun with it. You know, you're sharing this love, this passion for aviation that you have with another person who has a love and a passion for aviation. So as much as it will be stressful and you'll be nervous because, yeah, it's an evaluation. No. Don't look at it that way. It's just another flight with somebody else who really loves flying and they want to share it with you. And, hey, you're going to learn something during this too. You're probably going to learn multiple things. So, yeah, good luck, Tammy.
Good luck, Tammy.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. What else is going on? So I got to give a shout-out to Dale Edward Lee. He's down in Providence, and I was working on the aero, changing out some carpet for the trip out to Oshkosh, trying to make it as comfortable and friendly in there as possible. And the sun's blazing in the hangar, and I'm sweating and working hard, trying to get out of there before 5 o'clock, and I'm out of water. And he comes by and he's like, "Can I do anything for it?" I go, "Yeah, man, can you fill my water bottle?" And he's like, "Yeah, man, be right back." And I go, "Cool, just get a shout-out on the podcast." So Dale Edward Lee, thanks a lot, man. And good luck with all your training. Let me know if you need any help with anything, buddy.
All right, and we also got Ed on social media asking us a few questions.
Ed!
Ed.
All right.
So Ed just got his private in April. He was a 150-hour student also, Matt, referring to me, so I'm still working on it. I'm getting there. and he's enjoying learning more about flying and aviation from us, so that's awesome, Ed. Thanks for the compliments. He has a couple questions. First, number one, what is each of our ultimate goals in aviation? We could start there. Rob, you want to go first?
Yeah, world aerobatic champion and air show performer, Red Bull Air Race pilots, basically want to take over the world. Is that, well, the aviation world, I suppose. That's pretty much
that's
it.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, that's it.
That's a good answer. So with regards to me, mine are just under, slightly under Rob's goals.
You mean world domination? Slightly under world domination? Is that?
Yeah, I was trying to make a joke. Ed, my goal is so I'm post solo a couple times. I'd love to get my ticket here. You know, life has kind of I do have multiple projects that I work on at any given time, and you know, so sometimes I start, then I stop again. But aviation is such a passion of mine, and I love doing this podcast. And I love flying. So, you know, love to get my ticket here pretty shortly. And then, you know, continue learning with Rob, or gosh forbid, another instructor to keep moving down the path.
No!
and getting, you know, instrument rated, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think the description of this podcast will be accurate for quite a long time, because it will always be a CFII and a student. And we always have to remember that Rob is also a student. He's also always learning, and that any ticket you get, any certificate you get in this industry, is a ticket to learn, as Rob always says, right? So, so Rob, you're always a student. I don't know if at any given time I'm an instructor. Have I ever taught you anything? I don't think so.
Well, maybe not explicitly. Like, you didn't necessarily set out to try and teach me something, but I learned from you as well. If not lessons in life and business, but also in the way that people learn and different personalities learn. I learn how to teach you, and I learn how to teach people like you. So that it helps me expand what I'm able to do just by interacting with you. And out of the mouths of babes come these questions that I've never thought of. You ask questions from your point of view, and right. It makes me think about subjects, and you really start to learn things when you're teaching it because of those experiences, because the students being four-year-olds and asking, why?
And I think I once taught you something about, I can't remember. We were at your house at one point recording one of these episodes, and I said something, and you said, I didn't know that, but I can't remember what it was.
And I learned it well, apparently.
Yeah. So Ed, and then, you know, eventually, you know, I'd probably just like to continue to fly in any capacity. I don't really have any plans to move past general aviation, although you never know what's going to happen. So thanks for that question. Question two from Ed: what has been our greatest accomplishments in aviation? My greatest accomplishment in aviation was landing on runway one center at Dulles International Airport with Rob. That was awesome. And I'd say my second greatest accomplishment in aviation was soloing. That was awesome. That was a great experience. And I still have my cut shirt that Rob cut the day I soloed, and you know, every time I look at that, I remember that accomplishment. It was absolutely awesome. So, Rob, how about you?
Yeah, first solo is still something that sticks in my brain. I don't necessarily know why, other than it was the most awesome experience of my life up to that point, being able to fly an airplane by myself. And I remember getting my flight instructor certificate, the first one. That was a huge accomplishment. I was very, very proud of. But in I've had the opportunity to compete in aviation as well, and I won a national collegiate championship in 2009 with the NIFA program. And I've won at least one aerobatic contest down at Cathy. Oh, wait, no, where was that one? Yeah, that was Kathy Jaffe. No, yes, that was Kathy Jaffe. Got to remember. And so I suppose those victories are really cool. But there's also another 1,000 memories that I can't quite label as an accomplishment. But some of the things that I've gotten to see simply because I'm a pilot and gotten to experience because I'm a pilot, they feel like an accomplishment. Because I'm a part of this club, because I've earned this certificate, and that's a very tough thing to describe. But yeah, it's got to be up there with the contest victories and that first solo.
You guys talk an awful lot about drinking. What's your favorite drink? Well, that's an interesting question, because I don't think either Rob or I drink that much. I would have to say my favorite drink of choice when I drink is Guinness. It is a nitro beer that is light in calories, light in alcohol, and is really good on my stomach.
So good.
So Rob, I know you're kind of in the same boat, but if you had to pick a favorite, what's your favorite?
Oh, I got a tie. I got two. A Rusty Nail and a snake bite chilled.
Nice.
Yeah, have you ever had either one of those beverages?
I've never had snake bite, yes. Rusty Nail, no. Okay. Never heard of it.
Yeah. Rusty Nail is scotch and drambuie. It's very good.
And do you need a tetanus shot when you get that?
You should probably have one within the last 10 years. Yes.
Yeah.
Don't drink and drive. 8 hours bottle to throttle. 0.04 BAC. Not under the influence.
Yep. Good advice. Good advice. all right. So a couple quick social media questions. First, we posted a picture on Instagram and we said, what is this? And it was a long silvery thing. Rob, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that was a starter that for whatever reason decided to detonate itself. We think it overextended and the gear punched into the casing around the Bendix. And that's what happens when high speed metal hits stationary metal. You get little metal pieces. So yeah, that was a starter. For all those who guessed starter, you are correct.
Good job. It was most people guessed starter, so it was really awesome. And then what plane were you flying the other day? We asked that as well, and most people guessed it correctly, but go ahead and tell us about it.
Oh, no, that was a Piper Aero. So I was actually coming back from working on the Aero, changing out the carpet. We did an oil change. We looked over all the inflated the nose wheel strut. It was within tolerances, but I wanted a little more clearance, considering that going to Oshkosh we may have to taxi through the grass, as that's kind of a standard parking place up there called the North 40, and I wanted as much propeller clearance between the ground and the nose wheel as possible. So we took that to the upper limit of its inflation.
Air.O.Smith wants to know, why don't Americans pronounce turbine correctly?
What, you mean turbine?
Turbine?
I don't know how he wants to pronounce it. There's right. One way to write it, so I can't quite tell from his question if turbine or turban is the correct thing. But when I think turban, I actually think the wrap around your head of certain religious groups. But whereas a turbine could be something on... Well, anything driven by exhaust gas, basically. That's what's in my head. But I don't know quite how Agreed. he wants it pronounced.
Yes, Aerosmith.
Send us an audio clip of you saying the word properly, and it might get featured on this audio podcasting here, you know? With your permission, of course.
Yes, love content. All right. Well, should we talk about stall recovery tales from the ramp?
I was thinking a little more, Brecko, on reality versus procedure.
All right.
And this is a very interesting thing that I've kind of seen recently on student flights and stage checks. The student understands what the procedure is, and they understand what they're supposed to be doing. But unfortunately, they kind of get into this fantasy world where they think they're doing it, but they haven't actually moved the switches or moved the throttle or pulled on the yoke or stepped on the rudder or any of those things. They'll say the words, like, mixture rich, and they'll stare at the mixture, and I'll kind of look at them and wait patiently. And then I'll look at the mixture, and I'll look back at them, and they'll look down at the checklist, and they'll look over at me, and they'll move on to the next item. And I go, whoa, 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 whoa. You just said mixture rich. Well, yeah. Are you going to do it? Oh, I didn't think I was supposed to. Well, it wouldn't be in the checklist if you weren't supposed to do it. So don't get wrapped up in the procedure and saying the words. The words are there because they are supposed to be an action involved with them. All right. So it's not necessarily a do list. It's still a checklist to verify that you did the action. Kind of see the same thing in steep turns and the nose starts to drop and they go, oh, the nose is falling. I need to get on some back pressure. And they may increase the amount that they're pulling on the yoke, but the yoke doesn't actually move backwards. So the elevator doesn't get displaced. So the angle of attack never goes anywhere. And the airplane continues on its downward trend. And they wonder, why isn't it working? So there's some interesting things there that the reality of what's going on, they understand the procedure, but they're not seeing what's really happening. They know what's going on. It's in their head. It's in their brain. But they just can't make the physical action happen. Yeah, that's my rant on reality versus procedure. I guess that was more of that was me venting more than necessarily constructive anything. But yeah.
No, and it's interesting, too. It's interesting too, because I've done the same thing with the throttle. I remember there's times when you've told me, you know, add power. So I'll lean in and I'll like just kind of tap it. And you're like, no, add power.
We're still sinking at 1,000 feet per minute. Please add the power.
Physically move it. It's like, you know, and you know, in the GUMS check, gas undercarriage mixture, power switches and seatbelts. And I'm like, power check. It's like, no, there's actually something.
That's another one. When people say, you know, good in the cockpit. The word good is not written on any instrument. It's not written on any placard. It's nowhere in the cockpit. Fuel selector, good. No, it's either left, right, both, or off. Which one is it? Good is not an option here. You could say the tire looks good. Okay, fine. If the tire looks good, great. But you know, gauges, they're in the green. If they're not in the green, you better figure out why, or you might be having a problem. And there's kind of items like that. Power's good. Well, what does good mean? Be specific. If you're in a phase of flight where 2,000 RPM is where you want the power, and it's at 24, and you look at the power and say, power's good just because it's making power, you are at an inappropriate power setting for the phase of flight, which will result in the aircraft possibly doing something you don't want it to do, either climbing, which is most likely, or accelerating, putting you fast on your profile. Those are really the two options there. But making sure that you have appropriate settings and not just announcing good, say what the power setting is. Know what it's supposed to be. And if there is a difference between what it is and what it's supposed to be, change something. Make it so.
Number one.
Picard.
And what is your recommendation if anybody flying is having problems kind of hitting every item on the checklist? Perhaps they're skipping over some things, or they find themselves skipping over things here and there. You know, is it to go back three items? Is it to call everything out loud? I mean, what's been your best experience with good checklist performance, I guess, is the word.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about an on-the-spot correction, not a behavioral change.
No, I think more a behavioral change that involves, just like, you know, we talk about, here's what we're going to do if we rotate and we climb out and lose our engine at 900 feet. We have a plan.
Yeah.
What kind of plan should people have if they start realizing that they're missing a checklist item, or if they notice they missed a checklist item?
Okay. So have you ever heard the phrase, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
I have not.
Okay. The saying goes, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. You've probably heard the phrase, practice makes perfect. Have you heard that?
I have. Is that true?
Not quite. Perfect practice makes perfect. If you practice lazy, sloppy garbage, when you actually get into the stressful environment, you will perform like lazy, sloppy garbage. There's no such thing as rising to the occasion. You rise to your level of preparation. So if you notice a habit pattern of, oh, I'm missing this checklist item, or I'm not doing this quite right, you need to sit at home, not in the airplane, not in the stressful environment, not at 120 knots, not at 3,000 feet, not at 50 feet. At home, stationary, in a chair, no threat, and go slowly and deliberately through the checklist. Even on the ramp, engine off, airplane tied down, you just go out because it's your day off and there's an airplane sitting on the ground at your flight school that you can go hop into. Take the checklist out there. You don't need the keys, but take the checklist out there and sit in the airplane and run very deliberately and very slowly the items and procedures on that checklist. Visualize what you're doing. Visualize being in the airplane. There are studies that show that visualization is 80% as effective as actually being in the airplane, in the environment, and doing it. And those skills, those motions, those hand positions, where you're looking, all of that gets better put into practice in the stressful environment. So move these run these checklists, run these procedures slow and deliberate. There's another favorite phrase of mine. It's slow is smooth, smooth is fast. slow is smooth because you get to do the task and you do it right, and you do it right the first time. Whereas if you try to go quickly, you may miss. You may overshoot the control, and then you have to come back. And you may flip the wrong switch accidentally. And then you have to go back and shut that one off and turn the other one, turn the right one back on. And that always takes more time than if you had just looked, identified, deliberately moved, and flipped the correct switch. So slow is smooth, smooth is fast, because you don't have to double back and redo anything. So the keys to these procedural things is to sit at home, or to hangar fly, chair fly the procedures, the checklist, until you can't get it wrong. So practice does not always make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. And the difference between an amateur and a professional is that an amateur practices until they get it right. A professional practices until they can't get it wrong. End of sequence.
That was deep. That was good. I guess that makes sense. So then how would that apply in a situation where, for example, I know sometimes when I haven't flown with you for a few months or whatever, I miss something. And you know, one thing that I've gotten pretty confident at is using the checklist as a, not item by item checklist, but a, hey, let me look at the empennage, review all the empennage sections. Okay, now go back and check the checklist, make sure I didn't miss anything. At what point do you recommend people transition to that kind of practice versus going line by line?
Oh, that needs to happen sooner rather than later. The checklist, once again, is not a do list. It is not something that you should walk around the airplane with your face buried in the checklist, only glancing at the single item that the checklist says. You should be moving around the aircraft in a flow, and checking all the little things that you come across. And there are items on the checklist, but they may be several feet away from your current position, or the last checklist item. That doesn't mean that you should skip everything in between the last checklist item and the next checklist item. It means that you should be looking at everything in the airplane that is in between here and there, instead of being heads down buried in the checklist. And that takes time, that takes familiarity, that takes practice. And my first couple lessons with students, we will spend the bulk of the time on the pre-flight, getting them familiar with what the airplane looks like so they know what is right with the airplane. Because we want to find the things that are wrong. We don't want to take a broken airplane flying. So we pre-flight to find things that are wrong, things that are broken. And the only way to do that is with a CFI pointing out, hey, yeah, this is what it's supposed to be. And then after a couple of laps of demonstrated, oh, yeah, the student's got it now, I'll let them take it on their own without saying anything. And I'll watch what they do. And through their performance, I then develop the trust of, okay, they've got it. They understand what I'm trying to tell them. They understand the purpose of this, and they're going to catch the things. And some of the things that make me the happiest are when a student comes and gets me, or I walk out to the airplane, and they go, hey, I saw this. It didn't quite look right. Can you take a look at it? And I go, oh, nope, that's a good catch. That shouldn't be like that. I can fix that very easily as preventative maintenance. Or, nope, that's a major issue. We have to ground the airplane. And I'm super proud of those moments.
Like a gigantic dash in the flap, 2 feet long. Probably don't want to fly.
Yeah, somebody oversped those flaps.
Yeah.
No bueno. And probably didn't just do it once. It probably happened multiple times. But still, you want to find that stuff.
And Rob, as a CFII with your students, have you ever, or would you ever support some of the tales I've heard, such as putting Scotch tape over a pedo tube
a sticker. Sticker over the static port.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
or switching the controls.
Oh, nothing. So if you make the airplane unairworthy, that's technically a felony. So it's one of those things where you got to do it in a controlled environment. If you are going to bug an airplane, be very careful. Make a list of everything you've done and be able to undo it. I am of two minds on some of that. There are opportunities with maintenance to bug an airplane. You say, hey, we've got one in the shop for 100 hour already or for an annual. Let's do a couple little items to it and then have students pre-flight and see if they catch these things. Things like missing screws or nav lights switched or both nav lights being one color. See if they catch some of those things. See if they're paying that much attention. One of the things I've seen is a white sticker over the static port with a black dot in the middle of it. Oh, that's nasty mean, and it's very tough to catch. You really have to be paying attention. You have to get up in there close and be like, nope, that's not a hole, that's a dot. But at a glance, everything looks right. But yeah, I don't know about necessarily do it every time, but I have put my wallet in some places. I've stuck pens on top of ailerons, just kind of clipped them on in the diamond, and seen if people caught them. And then I do something special, and not only write down what I've done and then check it off after I undo it or after I get it back, but then I also cross my fingers in like an awkward way. I cross my forefinger over my middle finger and my ring finger over my pinky in this awkward, I don't know, Vulcan sign. It's not the most comfortable position to have your fingers in. And so that physical discomfort reminds me, hey, you have done something to this airplane. Don't forget to undo it. And I do the same thing if in a complex airplane, I pull a gear circuit breaker to simulate a gear failure with the complex students, with the commercial students. I'll do the same thing there, just as a physical reminder, I have changed something about this aircraft that makes it unsafe for landing. I need to fix it. It needs to be fixed before we get to the ground, and ideally before we even descend from whatever altitude we're at. So there will be things like that, and it's just extra little safeties and extra little checks to keep us from having a real issue. So, Matt, let's talk about our interview that we had with your buddy Dave.
All right, awesome. So, so Dave is a friend of mine. We go back probably 10 or 15 years, if not longer. He was my next-door neighbor growing up. He's a pilot for a pretty major airline and flies the A320, A321. And, you know, I've wanted to interview him because part of the reason that I started flying was not only, you know, as we learned in a previous episode, I was very big into flight simulator when I was a kid, but also that him being my neighbor, I would ask him questions a lot. And also my parents always said, oh, you should go flying with him. You should go flying with him. And they said it probably 20 times over a period of 10 years. And I just kept kind of stalling and stalling, not that kind of stalling, delaying going and, you know, just, you know, life gets the best of you. I mean, high school was busy, you know? But anyway, so, you know, Dave and I have kept in touch, even though I've moved to Boston and, you know, I've had the opportunity to fly with him a couple times. And, you know, I thought it would be good to ask him some questions about what his life is like. He's been doing it for a number of decades. And, so yeah, I think we'll hop right into that.
Excellent, Matt. So what's your first question?
What things have changed since you first started flying the A320 and what has become more automated? Can you give us specific examples?
Yeah, I will say this much. Ironically, the A320 in terms of technology is kind of archaic. The technology that they put into civil aviation, Cessnas and all that, the glass cockpit, you know, certainly the G1000 or all the, you know, navigation application, blows away what I fly. What's going on in general aviation is wonderful technology application. It's fantastic. And Airbus we're still locked into what was going on when they first introduced the airplane. I mean, the airplane came out in the 80s. When it's tried and true, they don't veer away. They stick to it and they make all these corrections. They make all these, the way I say this, you know, it's like a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound. Okay.
Yeah.
We can fix it and we can make it work. The better idea would be to, you know, totally scrap it and start over. But you can't do that in the airline industry.
It costs too much money. It takes too much time. It's too much investment.
Well, that's it. That's it. It's always about technology it's about money. It's about
retraining,
upgrading. It's about that ultimate change, you know. Yeah. Everything needs to, and that's probably true in a lot of other industries. You know, it's a subtle change. You can't just turn it off and turn it on. And
Well, Dave, you mentioned other industries. So we often make comparisons to the tech world, and you know, one of the things in tech is that you have two camps, right? You have one camp that says, well, this has been working for 10, 15 years. Let's make slow, small, iterative changes to something that's been proven. It might not be the latest and greatest, but, you know, the analogy I like to use is, you know, what can I fix at 2 a.m? What do I know really well? What can I do half asleep? It works, may not be the best, may not be pretty, but it works. And then you've got another camp that says, oh, this is new and shiny. Let's use this as soon as possible because theoretically it'll make things much better. Until, but there's so many unknowns in that, right? There's so many things you just don't know about something that's new. And when you don't think about those unknowns ahead of time, it seems like it's a brand new shiny object that's just going to work and it's going to be great until you start hitting these bugs, until you start hitting these pieces that don't work. And that's where you look back at the old technology or the technology that's worked for 15, 20 years, and you say, aha, it's mature, it's stable, I should have trusted it longer, I should have relied on it more. So I think that's a great analogy too, is I don't think they should just throw brand new technology into these airplanes. It should be slow and iterative, because at the end of the day, it's about being safe, right? It's about being safe and being stable.
There has to be this transition. You know, when everything falls apart, it's still look out the window and fly the airplane.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's very easy to get sucked into the technology and the, you know, reliance of automation. And it's a struggle. They're going to throw technology at us one way or the other. And it makes perfect sense. Technology equals efficiency. When I fly the airplane, it's manual takeoff. People are always about, okay, oh, it's autopilot, beginning and end. No, it's not, We take off, it's hands-on, the pilot flies the airplane, rotate, climb, and then, we turn on the autopilot. And then typically when we get down to the approach, we turn off the autopilot and we land the airplane. And don't get me wrong, the Airbus especially, we can auto-land the airplane. The airplane will land itself right to the bottom. And then we turn off the autopilot and we turn off the runway. But it's a very strange concept when we let the airplane do that, because the airplane does a good job, but at any given moment, you're thinking, okay, this thing is going to crush itself on the runway. And it's designed to do that. It's supposed to kind of, like, if there's any kind of contamination on the runway, it's going to do a hard landing, because a hard landing is better than greasing it on, because if you grease it on ice, guess what? You're slipping off the end. Okay. Yeah. If you kind of crush it on a little bit, it's a firm landing, but that's okay.
The weight's on the wheels.
Yeah, exactly that. And then our job as pilots has now become a combination of both. It's okay. There's a time when we got to hand fly it and make it work. And there's a time when you have to kind of accept technology, accept all of it, and accept it, but always monitor it. Okay. You are literally still on the controls, because at any given moment when it does something it's not supposed to do, that's where we come in. That's what they pay us to do. Okay. Ultimately when I was training, It was kind of hard, because you had these wonderful instruments looking at, you were looking at them, they were looking at you. A lot of my instructors, certainly my DE, my designated examiner, like, don't look at that, turn it on, I mean, maybe the one thing, pay attention to airspeed, maybe. I mean, certainly don't get me wrong. When you're flying instruments, that's the core thing that you learn to do. But in the end, you just have to feel and fly the airplane. And as pilots, this is what we have to do, regardless of technology,
That makes sense. It's like, and I think when I was flying with you once, and when I was flying with Rob maybe 30 times, trying to get to pattern altitude, and as I make my crosswind turn, I started getting into a bad habit of looking at the turn coordinator and being like, oh man, the ball's not right in the center. I'm doing this wrong. and Rob, and I know, actually you said this too, the first time we were doing the flight over Hillsborough, look out at the airplane, look out at the nose. If it's going off to the right, you're having problems. If it's staying in the center and you're feeling coordinated in your seat, you're fine. Forget the ball. And ever since then, it's been good advice. And I remember that. It's not about trusting the technology. The technology is there to help you. But like you just said, right. I mean, you could just fly the airplane. And especially for somebody like me who's learning, it's like a hard habit to get into. You'd think it'd be easy, but it's a hard habit to get into.
When did you start learning how to fly? What was your beginning?
My dad made the mistake of, becoming a private pilot and took me up for rides. And now I had the bug. ultimately, I got in college, and I thought it was the coolest idea ever to actually learn how to fly and get college credit. You know, it was just for me a wonderful thing where, you know, I'm doing something fun. I'm learning how to fly, and oh yeah, you're going to get 2 credits. You're going to get 3 credits. You're going to get 5 credits to complete these courses. I don't want to say it's bait, but it's, you do kind of fall into a very specific path. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, because they ask me, oh, what's your degree in now? You know, well, aviation technology. Yeah. It's always great to have a degree and apply yourself to a job and say you have this because that's what they want. But ultimately, most of that experience doesn't apply. You know, the stuff that you guys are doing that we all do, you know, general aviation, you know, fly the airplane, stick and rudder, you know, throw in some technology. And then, you know, move on, you know, do a charter job, do a corporate job, do a, you know, certainly the regionals, you know, that's the real applicable technology, but that applicable knowledge doesn't happen in college. But I think the concept is the college idea is, you know, you show to everybody, you know, airline or anybody else, you know, you are trainable, you know, you can learn certainly in kind of a stressful environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's the point of the whole getting a degree thing. But in the end, you know, so it's what you and I and all of us have done, you know, basic learning how to fly the airplane, you know, moving up to instrument training, enjoying or understanding that application, knowing it could fail, throw in a second engine. Oh, man, the thing drops out. What do we do? And you still have to apply your basics. You know, and this is a building thing that goes on and on and on. Specific to aviation and flying. Yeah. So, you know, the more hands-on stuff is definitely not a college thing, but it's certainly, it's certainly an education in its own right. And,
certainly.
You know, that's where I go with that.
Dave, building on top of that, so talking about education, what do you think of the pilot shortage right now? And what do you think the next 10, 20 years look like in that arena?
You know, it's funny because I think what's going on now is, and it's maybe too little too late, but when I came up and finally got my first job as a first officer in the Shorts 360, you know, flying a turboprop, big box, you know,
yep.
30 people in the back, I was making $7.50 an hour. And
eek.
I was happy with that. You know, I signed up, you know, I signed on and I was doing it. Nowadays, I think they're addressing the idea, you know, that the industry has realized, man, we can't find pilots. We've got a ton of retirements. The airline itself wants to grow and expand. They literally can't hire enough pilots. But the question is, well, why can't we? Well, the pilot pool is small, diminishing. I mean, what an incredible investment, okay? How much money do you have to spend to get those initial ratings and get your 1,500 hours and become an ATP, okay? Now, finally, airlines, certainly the regionals, but everybody, they're coming after guys and they're saying, okay, sign up. If you can make it into our door, we're going to pay you. I mean, after signing bonuses and longevity pay and all that, it's almost into $100,000 a year, mm-hmm. which is wonderful. It's survivable. You know, you can live in Philadelphia or New York
or
and
Boston.
Go fly for them. You know, in my day, you sucked it up. You know, every time I got close to the minimums that they were looking for, they bumped up the minimum over again. I was like, what? I finally got this 1,000 hours of multi-engine time. Now you want 2,000 hours. Yeah, that's okay. So it's changed a lot. That's all I'm saying. I hope it's not too little too late, but they might not find enough pilots. And it's a very interesting problem in the industry.
Yeah, Great Lakes Airline already closed.
Yeah, I know about a bunch of instructors who have like locked in preset hiring positions, providing, you know, all they got to do is, you know, once they had that magic, I think it's 1,500 hours or maybe it's less, I don't know. But when they hit that certain number, they can say, okay, I'm done with the flight school and I'm going to the airlines or the regional airlines.
We're literally seeing people get to 1,500 hours and at 1,501, they're out the door. They're gone. They've done interviews. They've interviewed, like, a lot of the airlines are taking interviews at 7:50, and then they're giving them, okay, well, you have until this point, or there's some places have programs where you get to 1300 hours or 1400 hours, and then they do the last 100 hours in a multi-engine airplane that the company sponsors, and your job is to bomb around the southern states of the United States, getting the minimum times, and then they go, okay, you got your 1500, come on. And they're putting them into sims.
It's wonderful. It's incredible fostering opportunity, and it was so opposite when I was coming up. But you know, I appreciate it because
Here's the downside to it, Dave. Here's the downside.
How's that?
The downside is a flight instructor can earn 1500 hours in about a year and a half. So they only get to give back and make new pilots for about a year and a half. And in those 61 world, that's enough time to get your private, your instrument, and start working on your commercial. But it's not enough time for a brand new CFI to gain enough experience to make a new CFI. And in the olden days where you'd spend 2,500 hours, a single CFI might make two or three other CFIs to replace them. Now, it's not happening, and it hasn't been happening for the last 5 or so years. We're having an instructor shortage, which is going to make a student pilot shortage, which will collapse the airline industry if we don't change something.
You know, again, this is a concept that was not a thing when I was coming up. I
mean, no.
I mean, we were locked in. You know, when I became a flight instructor, and that's what I wanted to do, you know, become a flight instructor, actually get paid to fly. It was wonderful. So I became a flight instructor, you know, maybe 1989 or something, 90. And all my instructors became regional pilots, commuter pilots.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, fat, dumb, and happy flying turboprops, doing some like great flying that I wanted to do. But it was a lockdown. It was like the whole thing just stopped.
Yeah.
And like you say, in light of that, now, you know, you're right. I'm training guys and they're getting better and they're becoming, you know, instrument pilots, CFIs. But the stagnation, I guess, worked because like you say, you know, now we've got pilots who are coming up and they're knowledgeable and they're genuine. And then everything, like for me, it was 1994, you know, all of a sudden the stopgate opened up. I got into the regionals and everybody else, you know, kind of kept moving forward. But it's, again, it's such an ironic opposite problem now. Man, you don't learn more than when you're trying to teach this stuff.
Right.
You know,
I've been doing it for 11 years and I'm still learning new stuff about really basic stuff.
You know, some students can kind of throw you, you know, honestly, in my experience, I don't want to say try to kill me, but I've had one or two instances where I'm like, whoa, stop, I got it, worked out. But you know, it's always fun to look back and say, wow, what was that? But
check out episode 7.
I will tell you this, and bottom line for me as an instructor, you learn to let them go. You learn to understand that there's more than one way to fly an airplane, and bottom line is you learn to accept that there are different ways to fly. A lot of guys who get like tied up in the idea, there's only one way, there's my way. It doesn't work so well. When you're the guy who can kind of let things go, when you're the guy who can see the end result, okay, he's doing it this way or she's doing it this way and that way. You know, bottom line is the airplane gets on the ground, it's safe. As an instructor, you're most able to do that. As another type of pilot, and you know, whatever, if it's military or if it's other airline or charter or something, a lot of those guys don't understand that. You know, they know, and it's wonderful. They grow up and they're trained in very specific SOP.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, there's more than one SOP, and you will find that out. Every company you go to, SOP changes, standard operating procedure. Yeah, and that's the point. You know, when you sign up and interview for an airline, all you can tell them is, hey, just tell me how you want me to fly it. I don't care. I can do it, and I will do the SOP or standard operating procedure that you want me to do because that's what you train me to do. Is it good, better, safer, not safe? No, it's not. It's always, you know, the concept of standard operating procedure is always about safe, but a lot of guys have a problem with, well, I do it this way because I think this is better. Hey, the walkway, I guess, from what I'm talking about, there's a fine line from standard operating procedure and technique.
Yeah. Okay?
You're going to learn SOP from whatever company you hire onto, but your own technique always enhances SOP. And there's a lot of room in SOP to apply technique. So, but the you know, it's a trick because you always have to, SOP has to come first without a doubt. But you always, as a pilot, and this goes right back to hand flying or any of it, what's your technique? What's the thing that you do that makes it just a little bit safer or just makes it a little more consistent? That's it, I mean, that comes through over and over again without a doubt.
Yep. When you're flying an A320 versus an A321, I'm curious, can you tell the difference?
Yeah. The 321, more mass, it moves quicker. And you have to just be more ahead of the airplane. You need to, and the airplane's wonderful. It's efficient. It likes to fly. But when you land and come down, you need to make it stop flying. So you, again, because the 321's bigger, you just have to be more ahead of making it do what you want it to do. Ironically, basically the 321 is just a longer fuselage, bigger airplane, same engines. So it's a dog, you know, performance wise, it doesn't do as well because it's just a bigger airframe on top of the same engines. But in that regard, you got more mass and you have to just stay ahead of it. So that's the difference.
You also can't dig yourself out of a hole because they're same engines pushing more mass.
Right. And it's easy to get behind because it goes faster as you come down. It's a dog going up. So the trick is to stay ahead of it because it's just a lot more mass and weight to contend with. So that's the difference.
So do you almost have to brief yourself ahead of time if you're in an A320 or an A321, even though it's the same type rating?
Well, again, you anticipate that this is the point of what Airbus or any manufacturer tries to do. They're trying to minimize that concept, that transition thing, because when you have to train somebody into an airplane, it costs money. But when you can get away with, okay, no, it's, you don't have to, it's not that different. They can say, oh, 320, 321, you know, be careful of this, but basically it's the same airplane. And honestly, the cockpit, even into a 330 or a 350 or a 380, the layout's mostly the same, but you know, certainly when you have bigger airplane and drastic differences, then yes, it becomes a different certification.
And the control laws are all the same between the different types too.
Oh, it's all insanely the same. You know, fly by wire, it feels all the same. But it works. You know, I will tell you what, you know, I enjoy the 321. I know what to do and what not to do in that airplane. And then when I fly the 320, you know, it's like going back and forth from a 172 to 152. You know, subtle differences.
Basically, Cessna.
You know what to do.
How many go-arounds have you had in your career in an Airbus?
That's a very good question. Not that many. It's our job, and more so it's air traffic control's job, to minimize that. When you do it, you know, in this airplane, you have to, especially because, you know, you've got two pause rates, bring the power up, you know, go around flaps, pause rate, gear up. But you do it so not often that it's kind of strange. And, you know, it's really to overspeed flaps, overspeed gear, overspeed, you know, anything. Cause now all of a sudden you're trying to keep up with a different profile. Okay. Your profile on the way down, it's easy, you know, okay. Descent, you know, landing, flare, touchdown, everything's great. But now all of a sudden you're pulling full power. The airplane's getting real fast in a hurry. And certainly you want the gear up. Okay. Now, oh, here comes the flap speed. Oh, bring the flaps up. Okay. Bring the flaps up again, clean it up. And then in the middle of everything, air traffic control is saying, okay, turn left, head this, you know, climb, maintain altitude, that, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, so it doesn't happen that often, but when it does, or the best thing you can do is practice it. You know, it's something you kind of take for granted. You know, in the Cessna, it's not that different, but but things happen a little faster in the jet, you know, full power, pull up the nose. You know, if you're in a complex airplane, you know, pause rate, gear up, you know, basic stuff, you know, flaps come up on speed, but in the jet, you know, one, it happens fast, and two, you have to do it with another guy, you know? single pile operation actually is it makes it easy or easier, I will say. But yeah. But you really have to coordinate things with the other guy and air traffic control when it happens.
So. And I guess this is a situation where a positive exchange of control is so important because you have to make sure you know like who's flying, who's in.
It is. And actually, it's ironic. One thing we always do is when you transfer control, you always tell the other guy, you have control, I have control, right? A lot of time, though, and I find this funny, and I make a point to kind of make it clear, but when the autopilot has control, nobody says that. And I find it very funny because it's a transfer of control, just like, you know, when you give it to the other person. And the one thing I try to say when I turn on the autopilot, this is not SOP, this is technique. I say autopilot on or autopilot one on, or actually I say AP one on because you don't want to confuse the guy. When you say autopilot one on, you're trying to tell the guy, oh, turn it on. And he's already turned it on. So the thing you need to say is you need to confirm it. So you got to make it different. So I say AP1 on, so he doesn't get confused. You know, it's part of cockpit resource management that it's an ongoing science. It's an ongoing evolution where communication, you know, you try to make it efficient and you try not to make it subjective. But that's an ongoing thing. You know, this is why training departments are in the business of what they do. They refine and they look at what's going on in the cockpit over and over again. And they try to trim out the stuff that can lead to ambiguity. They try to make it efficient. You know, I've seen the whole gamut. You know, initially you vocalized everything, you know, whatever the thing on the screen said, you reiterated, and it got to the point where, oh, there's so much talking in the cockpit, you know, you're missing radio calls. So now all of a sudden don't say anything. It's gone to the other extreme. Don't say it. It's okay. So, you know, you wrestle with that. You know, I'm fortunate enough to have experienced both, and you know, mentally I can see it and I can guard against it. You know, philosophies are very funny, and that's a big part of what we do. Our, you know, all of the flying. It's so much philosophy goes in. You know, and you question. You know, I mean. The best example I can give is, you know, watch air disasters on the Smithsonian Channel. You know, yeah. I mean, they say it, you know, the FAA's, you know, policy written in blood. You know, everyone has learned from mistakes. Yeah. It's actually true. You know, it's kind of morbid in a sense, but it's actually good too. You know, constantly look at those, you know, episodes and ask yourself, would I or could I have done this, or does this apply in the flying that I do, and can I avoid that?
Yeah,
you know, it's always a thing like that. You know, you learn from everybody else's mistakes. I think the best thing I've ever heard is the only mistakes that are bad are the ones that get you killed, but any other mistake, you know, you can learn from.
Very
you know,
good.
The ones that get you killed, you can learn from. Obviously, you know, so
other people can learn from those.
But what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? Dave, you spent 2.5 hours with us. We really appreciate it. You know, I mean, Rob is a, you know, CFII, MEI. I mean, he's got the day to day from an instruction standpoint, but neither of us have any experience in the airlines. So I didn't know if there was something else you'd want to share that we haven't asked yet that you think might be valuable.
You know, what I think always have come back to is, you know, the basic, you know, hands-on fly the airplane. I mean, that's the first rule. I'll ask my son, what's the first rule of flying the airplane? And I, you know, out of reflex, he'll say, fly the airplane first. That's so big regardless, you know, in civil aviation, in commercial airline aviation. And it, you know, based on record, that kind of went away a little bit. You know, automation and technology, it's easy to kind of fall away from that. And I think that's just the biggest point to make is that's got to be such a huge foundation. Our job is to, again, fly the airplane, work the technology, watch it, monitor it, enjoy it. But then when something starts to go wrong, as you know, and only has to go wrong like this much, okay, you're off profile, maybe 200, 300 feet. It's time to do something about it. You know, better to correct something early than way late, you know?
Yes.
Yep.
And that's you know, that's how it works in our business now. You know, and you know, in the beginning it was just, you know, it was easy. You know, we flew the airplane, you know, top to bottom. Now we're enjoying technology. You know, technology offers a lot of safety, but sometimes they all get in trouble. Yeah. And that's, we have to actually be more pilots now than before. You know, when you're, you know, hands on top to bottom, then yeah, you had ultimate control, but now you have to kind of stay ahead, stay watch. And it's easy to get complacent because the technology is wonderful. It's very mostly consistent, but there are days it can be off, and then you got to do something. And sometimes you got to do something early. And the way I always say it is, you know, I always love a boring day. Okay. If I'm having an exciting day, I'm working way too hard because that's not the point.
Yeah.
You know? So it's funny because people say, oh, you have such a great, exciting job. No, I have a kind of a boring job, but I like boring. Okay. Like I said, if it's not boring, then something's wrong or I'm working too hard.
It's like the 98% boring, 2% terror, right?
It's, you know,
like you said, know,
this is what you guys got to look forward to. It's, you know, it's fun either way, but you know, when there are days that you have to really kind of work it, there's maybe too much going on, but that's what we're paid to do. That's kind of the bottom line. So.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you very much for coming out and being on the Plane Talk podcast. It was definitely a pleasure having you. And Matt, you got an awesome buddy there.
Thanks. Yeah, he's awesome.
All right, moving on. What do we got next, Matt?
How about some core questions?
Core. All right, let's do it.
All right.
Oh, wait, weren't we going to call this questions from the internet? Because Cora was, we didn't want to. Questions from the internet. I might be able to do something with this. Hold on. Let me change. Questions from the internet. All right. We'll see how that sounds.
All right. Let's do some questions from the internet. I got a couple here. Number one, why do planes climb so high so fast after takeoff? Why not just climb gradually and gracefully?
Number one, there's a speed limit below 10,000 feet. You're not allowed to go faster than 250 knots. The airplanes are capable of doing much faster than that, so they want to get up into the thinner air to capitalize on their high-speed portion. Down low, turbine engines, I don't know how I'm supposed to pronounce it anymore, are just not as efficient as they are up at altitude. So you want to get up to where your engines are efficient, your wing is efficient, and your speed is maximum.
All right, good answer. Question number two. What does squawking mean, and why do I hear it in phrases like squawk dirty to me on ATC memes?
See, you beat me to the joke. I was going to try and do that too. So squawk code is the 4-digit code that is in the transponder that whenever the radar sweeps the airplane, the transponder sends that code back plus the altitude that the transponder is detecting that the airplane is flying. The radar then can take that code and pair it with what the air traffic controller has entered into the system as is the data for that airplane. And then it compensates for the non-standard altimeter setting to give information such as the type aircraft, the altitude, the ground speed, the 4-digit code. And with ADS-B, there will be some other parameters there too that it gets, or at least it will be very, very detailed and accurate. That's in the future.
All right, let's get a little bit more serious. Why do so many pilots and aeronautical engineers, etc., still do not understand how lift is truly generated?
Ooh, I think the engineers actually do a really good job of it. The problem is they're not CFIs and they're not teaching the next generation of pilots. So it may actually come down to more the pilots don't get it because the CFIs don't understand it. There is a bit of a change in the wind, and I'm trying to be a part of that as well, where all my students understand where lift comes from. And some of it too comes from some stubbornness, like people claiming that it was either all Bernoulli or it was all Newton or it was a combination, and really it's lift equation, it's the mathematics, it's the science behind it. And I was having a conversation with the head of MIT's aeronautical department, and that's not the technical term for it, but I can't remember what it is off the top of my head because I didn't go there. I'm a dumb Kent Stater. I'm just kidding. I love you, Kent. And I had just ferried his personal airplane to him, and he was giving me a ride back to the other airport that I took off from. And so I asked him the question, so who is it? Is it Bernoulli or Newton? And he said, at any given point, you can account for 100% of lift using either Bernoulli or Newton. And because you can account for 100% of it using either one at any given time, you also account for 0% of it at any given time. And I just sat there and stewed. I was mad. I'm like, okay, well, what does that mean? All right, how do we dig deeper? What is really going on here? And helped me pursue the lift equation, and he was like, yeah, that's what it's all about. And you can, it doesn't necessarily matter who it is. The math is the same. Where lift comes from is the same. So it's really combinations. It's neither one and it's both at the same time. But lift equation is what I teach. I will talk about how Bernoulli works, but I don't necessarily completely account lift to Bernoulli. I will talk about how Newton works, but I don't account 100% of lift to that. I talk about lift equation.
All right. And then finally, let's end on a little bit of a challenge here. It's an emergency, life or death, and I have to successfully make an old Cessna 172 take off and land on my own. I have never flown an airplane. Could I figure it out on my own with no training?
Oh boy. In my experience, no. The taking Joe Schmo with zero instruction, that's a recipe for disaster. Now, there have been flights where the pilot died and a non-pilot passenger was the only other person on board, and they were able to be talked to a successful landing by flight instructors or other pilots on the ground on the radio. And there was even a King Air 100 or a King Air 200 where the pilot died, the husband pilot died, and the wife non-pilot was talked to the ground by a flight examiner in the King Air on the radio with ATC. ATC actually called the guy and brought him into the tower or the center, wherever they were, and put him on the radio with her. And he was able to talk her into a landing that was survivable. The aircraft was damaged, but she lived, and that's what it's about. Unfortunately, the whole ordeal took long enough that her husband was not revivable, but we didn't have two fatalities. So, no.
And then here,
yeah, no, if you don't have any experience, it's not going to, no.
And then here's actually a similar question, kind of going along with that. I am a 20-hour student. I have just learned how to land. Could I land a twin if I had to? I assume learning just how to land in like a single engine 172, but that's an interesting related question.
Yeah, you probably could because it's an airplane. It depends on the performance characteristics of the twin. When both engines are functioning normally, it's not a big deal to fly. A lot of the multi-engine training is dealing with what happens when you lose an engine. I spend the majority of that time, of the training time with students, and us practicing the engine outs. That's the most stressful time. That's the time that can hurt you. Everything else, it's just an airplane. It turns. You roll the airplane with aileron and rudder. You increase back pressure. You increase power. Yeah, you could land it. The speeds would probably need to be higher. I'm just assuming we're talking 172 to Piper Seminole or similar type. They have a slightly higher landing speed. And if you try to use the same numbers, the thing's going to fall out of the, it's not going to fall out of the sky, but it's going to have a vastly increased descent rate than what you're used to. And you can jockey the power, you can run that as much as you want, but you might be able to figure it out. You might be able to fly it on no problem, just pointing the nose at the runway and pulling the power back, letting it work, and then fluttering at the last second. More than likely that'll be good. But hey, don't go trying anything without proper instruction. Hi Zoe.
Yeah, she's behaving herself today.
Yes.
All right. That's awesome. So I think that's it for core questions today. Rob, you want to take us home?
Yep. I'd rather take you to Oshkosh. So if anybody's out at Oshkosh this week, hit us up, Plane Talk PC on Instagram, and I'll be there. I'll be there Monday, hopefully, barring the weather delaying us, Monday through Wednesday. I'll be there for the night show as well on Wednesday, leaving Thursday morning, maybe late Thursday morning. We'll see. And would love to hang out with anybody that's there. Let us know if you're there, if you're hanging out. Let's get together. So, yeah, if you want to be on the Plane Talk podcast, we'll be shooting a lot of video. We'll be getting a lot of content. And my passenger, Rylan, or my student, Rylan, doesn't know it yet, but he's going to be my video guy. He's going to be my camera guy for the weekend. He's also going to be running Fly Horizon Aviation's Instagram. So he's done a little bit of features with me and him and myself on there as well. So Fly Horizon Aviation. And yeah, I think it's going to be a great time.
All right, awesome. Have fun, you too. Sorry I can't make it, but definitely we'll be there next year. If you like our podcast, please write a review on iTunes. You can check us out on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, on Twitter at Plane Talk PC, Instagram at Plane Talk PC, Facebook, Plane Talk Podcast, YouTube, Plane Talk Podcast, website, PlaneTalkPodcast.com, and, of course, please feel free to email us at any time, podcast@PlaneTalkPodcast.com. Take care.
And fly safe.
Musical bumper brought to you by Pogo. Check them out on YouTube.